a low of 15. Here are the numbers now. 14 degrees Racine, 12 in Kenosha, 10 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, wind chill 1 above. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. It is now 10 minutes after 8 o'clock. The morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the morning show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD-HD. I'm Gregory Berg. And it's always fun to welcome back into our studios Nan Calvert, who oversees these once-a-month visits under the auspices of the United Environmental Council. And we are always tackling an important environmental issue of one kind or another. Mm-hmm. And today we are talking about the trees, the trees around us. And Nan Calvert, did anything in particular prompt you to choose this particular topic?
Yes, it did. Because, you know, I come to you from Sino Conservancy. And among other things, we are a sustainable forestry operation. And most people don't know that about us. And
what does that mean?
Well, it means that we grow trees in order to harvest them for, you know, building purposes and making things out of wood. And I think that most people really don't know that that's going on just outside of the city of Burlington. And it occurred to me that most people don't really even know what that means, you know, forestry. What does that mean when you I think a lot of people think of harvesting trees, cutting down trees. They think of clear-cutting the rainforest. But forestry is much different than that. I mean, that is part of forestry in other places, but not so necessarily here in the state of Wisconsin. And in Wisconsin, we have a long legacy of family-owned forestry operations. And of course, most of them are up north, but there are some that are down here too. And then it occurred to me that urban forestry is it's a big deal. And a lot of things are happening within the purview of urban forestry for a lot of different reasons. And I thought, gosh, we have an urban forester right here in the city of Kenosha. And he was kind enough to come on, because urban foresters have to deal with many of the same kinds of things that, forestry operations have to deal with, whether they're big or small, in areas way north of us here in Wisconsin. So I thought it would be a really good idea that we talk about that and just get some awareness out of there of what a city forester can do for you as a as someone who lives in Kenosha, or anywhere that you have a city forester, and the kinds of things that Dirk has to deal with on a day-to-day basis.
So the gentleman in question is Dirk Nelson. He is one of two park supervisors here in the city of Kenosha, and one of the hats he wears is as the official City of Kenosha forester. So, Dirk Nelson, first of all, we welcome you to the morning show.
I am pleased to be here.
Good to have you here. You were telling us before we went on the air that you've actually been in your current position with the city of Kenosha for about 20 years. Let's learn a little bit about you ahead of that. Where are you from originally, and where did you get the training that sort of brought you ultimately to this position?
Well, I was born in Indianapolis and moved to the Wisconsin area when I was young, and moved to Madison from Milwaukee when I was about 8 years old, and that's where I grew up. Went to school at UW-Madison. My degree is in landscape architecture. I worked for a design-build firm as a landscape architect in the Middleton-Madison area for 12 years, and happened to see this posting for city forester in Kenosha, and it sounded intriguing, and so I applied, and here I am.
Did anything in particular get you interested in landscape architecture?
Actually, yes. One of my father's friends was a landscape architect for the state of Wisconsin. He designed all the roadways, all the interstate rest stations and things like that. And I thought that was kind of interesting. And I always did like forest trees and plantings and plants. So it was sort of a natural fit with my somewhat limited artistic skills. But as an architect, it was sort of fit.
Yeah. So you saw this job posting then in Kenosha. And was it for the position that you have now? I mean, did you... 20 years ago, is that what you were hired to do, what you're still doing today?
Yes, yes. My wife saw that posting and said, you should do this. Time for a change. I listened to her, and worked out.
Very good.
As usually it does.
So it's a complicated position being a park supervisor. You said there's two of you. Do you sort of split various responsibilities down the middle, or are both of you doing a lot of the same things but maybe in different parts of the city? How do the two of you work together?
It's evolving. Right now, we have our old supervisor retired, so we have a new one, and he used to be one of my arborists. So right now, actually, he's helping me with the forestry because he knows it very well. He was on the chainsaw end of it, and now he's at the other end, so it's interesting there. But yes, other than that, we split. Like, I've got the pools, he's got the golf course. I've got special events, flowers. We both have maintenance, mowing. We both supervise the city during salt and snow runs in the winter. We help streets do that, so.
Wow. I just can't imagine keeping track of, I mean, when you think of all of the details that are sort of involved in the stuff of life in a big city. And then just one of the hats you wear, then, is the City of Kenosha forester. What specifically does that responsibility include?
Well, basically, the city forest is responsible for the health and well-being of the urban forests. That's what we call it. And in my instance, that would be the trees in the parkways along the streets between the sidewalks and the curbs, plus all the trees in our parks and public lands, whether it's a park or not. And we're responsible for maintenance, removal of any, and that includes removal, that includes pruning, that includes planting. And that includes information to the public about various aspects, whether it's the EAB nowadays or Dutch elm disease 2 decades ago.
Hmm. So you have no responsibility for the trees that are, for instance, in somebody's yard on somebody's private property, or do you?
It would be limited. If those trees pose a public danger, which would be a danger, it's defined as a danger where someone on public land would be possibly injured, whether by disease or something else, then it would be in my purview. But normally, if it's just, say, your neighbor doesn't like your tree, we stay out of that.
Yeah. Okay. That sounds like a good idea. So when it comes to making decisions about what should happen with certain trees, like looks like those trees maybe should come down, or they're getting too big, or we need some trees right here to be planted, are those decisions you make? I mean, is that, does your position include that kind of authority, or are you more the action man that you are implementing the decisions that somebody else is making about the planting or removing of trees?
No, I'm granted those. That's part of my job. I'm given those powers, and I report to the park superintendent, who in turn reports to the public works director. So everything I do is under their purview, but I'm given the independence to do what is best for the urban forest.
Mm-hmm. So on a given day, are you typically behind a desk, or on a typical day, are you out and about actually looking at the trees yourself?
Well, my desk is my Ford F-150 that they give me. And it's a lot of inspection of trees. It's a lot of, we get a lot of people calling in. Right now it's about the EAB, check my tree for EAB, emerald ash borer. Mm. And we have to go out, we inspect it. We will give them a written notice, what we're going to do, what's going to happen, if anything. And it's sent to them so they're aware. We try not to surprise anyone. Taking trees down without notice is not a good thing. So it's a lot of times windshield time.
Right. And so you get calls. You, in a sense, get summoned. I mean, in addition to just looking over the trees that are directly your responsibility, you're also responding to concerned citizens about their own trees.
Oh, yes.
I can't imagine what kind of time that takes and the scope of that responsibility. When we're talking about the urban forest, namely all the trees that are on the boulevards and public streets and in the public parks, do you have any idea how many trees we're talking about?
Right now, we had an estimate of some 27,000, of which 5,500 are ash trees. But currently, the Public Works is working on, this is the fourth year, hopefully it's done, a tree inventory, which is something we've needed for a long time, where we have interns go out with tablets, and they'll mark every tree, its size, its condition, its species. So we will have a good tool to have. We'll have a good pinpoint accuracy on what needs to happen and where. We can target all, like ash trees, we know where they all are, and therefore we know what has to happen and what impact it's going to have on the urban forest and how we're going to have to reforest those areas.
Right. You know, I'm reminded of some years ago when there was a very heavy rain and then extremely strong straight line winds that ended up uprooting all kinds of trees. And one of the things I was so struck by was, I teach at Carthage, and there were huge trees on the campus of Carthage that were uprooted by these sort of freakish winds. And I remember I was down shopping in Illinois, and as I was driving back, you know, we had a little rain down there, but I had no idea what had happened. And then the first tree I drove past was actually on the grounds of Parkside. And I sort of drove past it before I realized, wait a minute, that tree was uprooted. That's not supposed to be like that. And then I passed another one and another one and another one. I thought, what in the world happened here? It was something out of a nightmare. And my recollection with on just the grounds of Carthage alone, something like 100 trees were uprooted, which was a tragedy. But the other thing that was striking to me was it was remarkable how many trees were left. And that's when you realize how many trees there are. I mean, I think we don't stop to count the trees the same way we don't stop to count the birds. And actually, if you do like a census of trees, it's actually remarkable how many there are, which just, in a sense, quadruples what your responsibilities are. You're responsible for all those.
Right. Sometimes you can't see the forest for the trees.
Right.
Southport Park and that storm, that was, I think, June 30th of 2011. We lost 85 trees in that park alone. And that was pretty bad, that whole Third Avenue corridor. It hit mainly along the lakefront there.
Oh, yeah.
Carthage, of course, also.
Right. Yeah, it was a scary, scary thing. Mm-hmm. So that's part of what happens is that when a tree gets uprooted or severely damaged, it's at least partly your responsibility to see that that tree is safely removed. Is that obviously when a tree is uprooted, there's no question. This tree is gone. This must be removed. Are there other cases from like lightning damage or other kinds of wind damage where the tree is still rooted, where it's kind of a difficult question of whether or not this tree should remain?
Yeah, it is. It is. We try to err on the side of being conservative there because you don't want anyone's life or property damaged or hurt because of a tree when you have prior knowledge that it may be damaged. So, but yeah, you also get a lot of vehicle strikes. We call it the orange lightning when the garbage trucks will go run the curb and hit their limbs up above. And every now and then they catch it and we have to pull it off the garbage truck. But yeah, it's always a call, and that's kind of what we're trained for.
Right. And, of course, the other matter, which we need to spend a fair amount of time talking about, is the matter of when a virulent pest comes in, like the emerald ash borer, and does untold damage. And, of course, the other story is sometimes disease comes in. You mentioned earlier in the interview Dutch elm disease. Now, I remember Dutch elm disease in Iowa, where I grew up, from the early 70s. Has Dutch elm disease been something that you've had to deal with in your time at Kenosha?
Not as much as the people before me, but when I came 20 years ago, there were still stately American elms. And it's amazing, even though there's very few, they've all succumbed. I don't think there's any in the parkway. There used to be some beautiful ones along the church on 75th and 22nd. They were big. And they have all slowly gone. Hmm. So that was not good. You also have some things you get every fall. You get tar spot, which is a black spots on maybe mainly Nauru maple leaves, and we get a lot of calls on that. That doesn't really hurt the tree; it just doesn't look good. And you get gypsy moth every now and then, and that's a cyclical thing. We've had planes in the past come and spray our trees to solve that, but that's a cyclical thing. Same with the Japanese leaf beetle; you'll get those. And sometimes they're bad. They'll completely take all the leaves off a linden tree. They like those. And other years, like the last few years, they haven't been bad. So everything goes in cycles.
It runs in various courses, I suppose.
And oak wilt, is that a problem?
It is, but that's something that the main way to stay away from oak wilt, as you know, with your conservancy, is you don't prune during the active years. You prune when it's dormant. And that's always going to be around, but it's controllable.
So in terms of the well-being of trees in general, particularly in terms of trying to help them fight off potential diseases, are trees, generally speaking, fertilized in any way? Or is that typically not an appropriate course of action with trees?
It's typically not done by the city in terms of our parkway trees just because of the expense and the manpower we have. When we plant them, we got to remember also that a parkway is probably the toughest spot a tree can ever grow in. It's surrounded by concrete. It's got usually it's poor soil to begin with because that's what's left from the house. You've got salt from the road. You've got light pollution from the overhead lights. So you have to choose your species, and there are species that are urban tolerant and will do better in those situations. And putting mulch over the base of the tree helps a lot. It keeps the moisture in, and that's more than anything is really what's going to help your tree survive in the urban forest.
Interesting. The trees that we see in the parks, I mean, like we were talking before we went on the air about gorgeous Lincoln Park, and that's just one of the beautiful parks here in Kenosha. How many of those trees were, in a sense, specifically planted by Kenosha, I mean, by somebody long before you came along, versus how much of that is just what happens to be growing there?
I think in Lincoln Park, especially in the northwest corner, those look like they're open-grown oaks. Those are big oaks. They take a long time to grow. I think those were there. But most of the other parks, unless it's a new one, like Strawberry on the other side of the eye, most of those have been planted by me or by my predecessors and as part of the program.
Mm-hmm. Typically, what kind of choices are made, or what is the process by which that determination is made about what kind of trees belong where?
Well, as far as the parks, we like to go with indigenous trees as much as possible. And in a park, it's a totally different ballgame because you can get big trees. You can have trees with fruit, unlike you don't really want those in a street situation because of the slippage and messes. But in the park, you can let them get big. Therefore, on the lakefront, we're trying to reintroduce beech, which used to be native along the shore, and it's sort of gone away. So beech trees and of course, sugar maples, trees that are not good in the parkway because they're susceptible to salt or compaction, they will grow in a park. So it's sort of a different palette of trees compared to what we plant in the parkways, which are honey locusts, urban-tolerant trees, crab apples, Japanese tree lilacs. And what we do is we allow the homeowner a choice. We have, say, 15 species, and we'll let them choose because we want to make sure we keep a diversified forest. That's kind of key after we've gone through the ash and the Dutch elm. You don't want blocks and blocks of mono species because that's you're just looking for trouble.
Right. Could you, by the way, just explain specifically what you mean by the parkway?
The parkway is, by definition, the lawn park between the sidewalk and the curb.
Right. So when you first were talking about that, I was picturing in a wide boulevard.
Boulevard. Okay.
And the trees that might be planted in that sort of median area. Mm-hmm. But when you're talking about the parkways, you're actually talking about something that's actually closer to people's homes.
Right. You can include the boulevards as parkways, too. We don't have that many. Like Lincoln Road is a good example.
Right.
Those are all hybrid elms because the original American elms all died.
Right.
But, right, you get that cathedral corridor going down there.
So that space between the sidewalk and the curb is actually owned by the city. Is that right?
Or yeah, that's kind of a gray area. We're actually working with legal right now on that. But the homeowner is responsible for the maintenance of that area and improving it, which would mean they've got to have grass. You can't have grass over 8 inches long. You've got to keep your trees pruned so they're safe for both the public and private.
Okay. For those of you just joining us, we're speaking with Dirk Nelson, who is the City of Kenosha Forester. That's one of the aspects of his considerable responsibilities as one of the two park supervisors here in Kenosha. And, of course, also with us is Nan Calvert. Nan, I just saw your eyes light up as Dirk Nelson was talking about the reintroduction of indigenous species. That speaks to you, obviously.
Yeah, it's so important with shrinking habitats all over the globe. Wisconsin is no different in loss of native habitat. And sometimes, you know, parks are beautiful places. They're so necessary. But sometimes parks are referred to the habitats are called turf and trees because you have turf and you have trees. You don't necessarily have a woodland landscape or a savanna landscape. But when you can use native trees, especially oaks, as we've mentioned so many times before, they support over 500 species of native moths and butterfly caterpillars. Boy, you go a long way toward, you know, creating some semblance of habitat for them. And, you know, when you think about groups, you know, here in our own communities, like Sierra Club, that works in Racine and Colonial Park and other places to introduce native herbaceous species, you know, under native trees, and they clear buckthorn and honeysuckle and garlic mustard. When you have a concerted effort like that, it's a terrific thing for the habitat, for environment, but also for people.
Right. Now, do you see any concern at what Dirk Nelson was outlining is sounds like a fairly limited number of trees that can even grow at all in, for instance, the parkways. And what he was listing off, those didn't sound like particularly indigenous species.
Right.
But I suspect that we aren't looking at quite the same issue as we are with other I would think these aren't invasive in the way that other kinds of plants are. The fact that they're not indigenous is not quite the same issue.
Right. So as Dirk mentioned, the urban environment is really, really tough for trees because, you know, when you think the vast majority of their root system is underneath pavement, whether it's asphalt or cement, that makes it very tough. And then you have this narrow strip of ground that we call the parkway. And some of the trees that are planted, you know, if it's an oak or a maple, they can get quite large. So it's really confined and compressed. And then they have to be pruned in such a way that, you know, people aren't hitting their heads when they walk underneath them or cars and trucks aren't snagging on the branches. You have strange hydrology conditions. You have terrible soil. And then you have applications of some sort of a de-icer, whatever that might be. And then you have all kinds of runoff from the use of herbicides and whatnot to maintain perfectly perfectly green turf and all of those kinds of things. So to find tree species that can withstand that. And then I'm so happy he mentioned light pollution from streetlights. It's tough on a tree. Trees, plants in general, trees, no different, they have light and dark cycles that they need. So it's a really tough environment for trees. And it's sort of a miracle that we have a number of species from which to choose that can withstand that. So we were talking before we went on about Greendale and the boulevards along Edgerton off of 76th Street and how they've been re-engineered to accept native plants. And in the boulevards, it's mostly herbaceous species, so flowering plants and grasses. I think there are some small woody species in there. So some communities are working on introducing native species along those lines. But that environment is even much different than the parkways between our streets and our sidewalks. The boulevards along the street, you know, they're larger and they can be engineered as bioswales and all kinds of things. So even that is a much different microhabitat than what we're talking about here.
Right. So in other words, if we're going to have trees on those parkways, in a sense, we don't have the luxury of being particularly choosy.
No, not always.
and it's better to have trees.
Oh, yes.
Some kind of trees, even if they're not indigenous trees.
Oh, absolutely. Because, you know, when you think about an urban setting, it's a big heat island because there's so much cement, there's so much asphalt, there's so many rooftops. And we don't often think about shade being essential. But you have to have shade in order to, you know, survive those hot days. You have to have shade for a little bit of water conservation to slow down evaporation. So it's really important to have good canopy in those boulevards and also in the parkways, but also in the boulevards to help offset that heat island effect.
So the shade, as much as anything, is besides just trees are pretty to look at.
Exactly.
General.
It's really, really important. And when you think about parking lots, whether it's in an urban or an exurban or a suburban setting, we could do so much to redesign parking lots so that they could tolerate native tree species, you know, instead of having all of those little tree islands elevated above the level of the parking lot, make them below the level of the parking lot so they can be bioswales and filter all that runoff because it's so heavily laden with certainly automobile chemicals and other things. So there, you know, it's slow in coming, but things are changing a little bit. People, you know, municipalities are starting to think about water quality and runoff and all of those things, erosion control, and how you can utilize living things like trees and other plants to benefit you.
Yeah, to make a difference for the better. Well, we certainly need to talk about one of the great villains in this whole story. We haven't touched on it very much yet, namely the emerald ash borer. I remember, you know, as we first began hearing about this a few years back, it was one of the scariest things because it was like this slowly encroaching enemy. And you would hear about the decimation it was causing in other places, and those other places were getting closer and closer and closer till, of course, eventually the emerald ash borer is here. Can you remind us kind of the time frame in which the emerald ash borer first began to be something that we were hearing about, even though it wasn't here yet? And then at what point did it start to become a sad reality for us as well?
Yeah. It began in Michigan, and I remember reading the early reports in the Detroit area. I think it came on packing crates from China. And that was in the early 2000s. And at that point, they were doing any tree within X number of miles or half a mile or whatever of a tree would be removed. Any ash tree within that kill zone would be removed automatically, which that's because it was an early, they were working on solutions, and that was one of the early solutions. And it didn't work, of course, because the bug was too mobile. And you could see also in Michigan where it would pop up along the lake where people would take their firewood. And it would be transported from the metro area where it was affected. And you could see it, little brush fires popping up where people would vacation. And it showed up there, and you could see that. So we knew it was going to be here. It was only a matter of time. And in the early 2000s, we started preparations such as not allowing ash trees to be planted anymore in the city or in any of the any of the businesses that have come to me on the site review committee for their landscape plans. We approved those. So we took action there.
And by the way, was that a fairly typical action? As far as you, maybe you don't know, but I'm just curious, would that probably be a typical protocol for a lot of cities sort of in the path of this thing?
It sure should be.
Right, okay.
Yeah, you can read the writing on the wall. You know it's going to come. You don't want all your new trees that you just planted to be taken out. That doesn't do anybody any good.
Right.
So, and then we also culled at that point. We were culling ash trees that were either under power lines or were sickly. We tried to take out anything just to get a jump on it. When it did come, that was, I think, 2009, 2010, in that time frame, on the corner of 75th and Green Bay Road, and just outside the city limits, there was one, and that's all it took.
So like you, that says something about the seriousness of this threat, that you remember the tree, you remember the spot, and I suppose you and your staff and probably a lot of citizens were even watching for this. What were or remain the telltale signs that an ash tree is succumbing to the emerald ash borer?
Well, right now you'll see the bark has some gray patchiness to it. You'll see a lot of witch brooming or suckers coming off the main trunks and the main limbs of these trees, because what they're trying to do is they're trying to get nutrients they need, and they're pushing out new limbs.
The tree itself,
right. And you'll see the canopy. A lot of the canopy will be destroyed. It won't be there anymore. It's becoming very easy now. When it first came, we didn't know what we were looking for, but it's second nature. Now you can drive down a street in any city in Wisconsin and say, oh, yeah, they got problems.
With the emerald ash borer.
Mm-hmm.
This, what about at Sino?
Oh, devastating. We lost 4.5 acres of ash stands. You can look at it in two ways. Ash trees are a beautiful landscape tree, and they're also important habitat for other native species. So it's a loss in that regard. And then when you look at people who have forestry operations, regardless of the size, it's a huge economic loss for them. Mm. So, and then for people who just love trees, it's pretty devastating to see your trees just become infected and die, and there's not very much you can do about it. So we had to take down all of our ash, but we're going to be replanting this spring, and like Dirk said, you don't want to relegate yourself to one or two species, because who knows what's coming down the pike. So we're going to be replanting with a wide variety of hardwoods as well as some conifers, but it's been a big loss for the state of Wisconsin and everywhere else.
Right. What is it about the emerald ash borer? I think one of the things that is so maddening about it, infuriating, is that we seem so impotent to be able to do anything about it except cut trees down. What is it that makes this such a unvanquishable foe? I mean, what is it about it? And I that's something I still am grappling to understand.
The main problem is it was something that our trees weren't adjusted for at all. It's kind of like the smallpox and the Indians, the Native Americans. It's something they were totally unaware of, something they had no protection for at all. Same with the trees. There's just nothing, no protections. In China, the ash trees, it's a minor problem out there because the trees have evolved and developed, and they deal with it.
Ah.
But these trees here have never seen it, and it's all of a sudden they're being hit, and there is no defense. There are some chemicals that you can apply. We tried triage, which is one of the better chemicals, and that's directly injected into the trunk so it stays sealed, which is better for the environment. And we did that in some of our outlying subdivisions like Whitecaps and a couple places like that, mainly to slow this down, to make this process not a 2 or 3 year, but a 7 or 8 year to help spread it out. And even that wasn't as successful as we had hoped. So
the other problem is that it's an insect, and insects are highly adaptable creatures, and they can withstand an awful lot. There's that part of it. The other part of it is that it's in the tree. So how do you attack something that's worked itself into the living part of a tree? And especially when the tree's circulatory system, if you will, is interrupted. And so the sap can't flow back and forth anymore, because the larva has burrowed in there, and it's interrupted that flow, and then you have canopy die-off. So how do you treat it? You can't just, you know, spray a tree. You can't do a foliar spray. You can inject something into the trunk, but as Dirk and I were talking about earlier, you know, the more times you insert something into the living part of a tree, that's an injury to the tree, and hopefully it will heal. And if it's a healthy tree, it will heal, just like when you tap a maple tree for sap to make into maple syrup. But now you're going to have multiple injections in a tree that's already quite ill, and can it withstand those? Dirk was talking about the soil drench earlier, but now that's sort of, it's a real sort of a, if you will, a non-targeted approach, and you're just drenching the soil with this pesticide. And so what other far-reaching implications does that have? Hmm. And it's just like any other invasive species that we've ever talked about. They come here from somewhere else. All of their checks and balances are gone.
Right.
And so there's nothing to hold them at bay. Although Dirk and I were talking earlier about there's some research being done and certainly real-world applications of some sort of a wasp, that a biocontroller.
Correct, a parasitic wasp that also came over from China as an answer to this, and it's very small. It doesn't sting. But what it does do is it burrows into the insect larva and kills it that way. And we've worked with the DNR, and Nash Park was our first program where some of these were released, two or three types of these micro wasps. Again, they don't sting, they don't bother humans, and this is the understanding, and I'm sure a lot of research went into this, so it's not, we're going to report another problem on top of the last problem.
Right. So you're saying that this is something that's been tried here in Kenosha? Did I understand that right?
Correct. We have about 4 years ago, I think, in Nash Park, we worked with the DNR on releasing them in that area. They wanted an area where there were a lot of ash trees, and it's the west part of Nash Park is pretty natural. Mm-hmm. So they put them in there and see what happens. And see if it.
So thus far, it seems to have made a positive difference, or is it too soon to tell?
I think it's too soon to tell. And I would suggest that they inject these or put these in places where the EAB hasn't hit yet. See what happens, because right now we're behind the curve and the trees are going anyway. But it's good for research because there are a lot of states that this hasn't hit yet. Hmm. So we're sort of a test ground.
Right. So how many ash trees in the city of Kenosha have gone down to the emerald ash borer?
We had about 5,500. These are just park trees or street trees, not backyard trees. And I would guess we've taken 2,000 to 3,000 down at this point. We still have a lot way to go, a lot farther to go, and our budget reflects that. Our tree removal budget has been increased as a response to this, and then our tree reforestation budget in a couple of years will also increase because we have to replant trees. We can't let the urban environment go. Like she said, there's so many benefits to trees.
Right.
We've got to have them.
Right. So is there ever a point in a place like Kenosha, then, where it makes sense to plant an ash tree? Or is this scourge with us for the rest of time? Or does the emerald ash borer move on to someplace else?
Those are all good questions, and there's a lot of university people working on that. Michigan would be the first place they would maybe try that, but I would think at this point, no, you don't want to replant it. Thankfully, it only affects ash trees.
Right.
Although I've heard a couple of species in Indiana where it jumped, but those are kind of rare species. And if that happens, all bets are off.
Right.
Right.
But at this point, they're just sticking. And it seems to us the green ash get hit before the white ash. Mm-hmm. White ash seem to do a little bit better job. And maybe that's just because they don't like them as much. But I think they're all going to go. It doesn't matter.
Right.
Part of the problem is the rapidity with which it spread. It's very similar to white nose syndrome in bats. It hit hard and it spread like wildfire. And you're working as hard as you can to try to find some sort of something to slow it or curb it. And in the meantime, you know, one after the other after the other.
And the problem being that it takes a while for the population to get to the point where it explodes. And in that 3 to 4 years, I'm sure it was here 3 to 4 years before we found it. But by that point, by the time you see it, it's already, you get exponential growth, and it's just, it's a nightmare.
Right. And then at that point, there's too much to do, and in some ways too, there's nothing to do. I mean, at that point, I mean the trees are already infected before there are the outward signs, and there's next to nothing that can be done at that point in the life of the tree.
Yeah, no, there is kind of a silver lining. We've got a big tub grinder out at our compost site, and we're taking the trunks of all these ash trees, and they're making excellent playground quality wood chips. So the city is saving hundreds of thousands of dollars on that. It's sort of a trade-off, but those trees are being used for all of our playgrounds because it's a beautiful, safe bark hardwood.
Right, but you sure wish they were trees.
I would just assume that they would stay in the, yes.
Right. Nan, you have some questions with you that you brought from some of the staff actually at CINO.
Yes.
First of all, just kind of explain a little bit about who these folks are who have some questions for Dirk Nelson.
Well, I polled some of my board members because they're heavily involved in the forestry endeavors at CINO, and some of them have small forestry practices on their own land. And I was really excited to be able to get Dirk to come on the show, and I thought, you know, I bet they'll have some questions for him. And one of them, of course, many of the questions actually centered around the emerald ash borer and what's the latest news, and certainly with the parasitic wasp question. One of the questions, what species of trees are you replacing the culled ash with, or what are you considering?
Well, like I said, two different types, mm-hmm. for parks and for the street trees. And the street trees is kind of the traditional. We like hackberries and honey locusts. Mm-hmm. And there's a hybrid silver red maple, which does fairly well. It doesn't have the worst qualities of the silver maple, and it's very urban tolerant. We've put a few London plane trees in. Smaller trees below wires would be the pears, but they have their own problems. Like this fall, you notice the heavy wet snow before the leaves come off, they get torn apart. But we use those flowering crab apples that are resist to scab and things like that, and a few other smaller trees. And then every now and then we'll throw a new species in just to see how it goes. Mm-hmm. I work with the nurseries in the area, see what they have, what's coming. And in the parks, again, it's the bigger majestic trees, and that includes conifers like larch, and like I said before, beech, oaks. Try to get sort of an arboretum effect of some of them. We're trying to do that on the lakefront with various species of oaks. Mm-hmm. And sugar maples, again.
I'm happy to hear you say hackberry in there somewhere, because those are fantastic canopy trees.
And then we've taken some smooth bark hickory. We've taken those out of Porio Nature Center, and we've put some of those in Lincoln Park. And that's a little bit different. You can dig those. You can transplant those when they're young. So we've been doing that. We have a spade.
Hmm. Very good.
I think you may have alluded to this in terms of budget, but is the city of Kenosha working with any of the homeowners for ash replacement?
It's a part of our normal reforestation program, and the city does shoulder most of the cost of that because we don't want to have urban deserts without trees. And some of the people in the inner city really – the funding is not there. They've got mm-hmm. more important things to spend that money on, in their opinions. So we're charging to replace a dead tree. It's a $25 replacement charge, which is pretty nominal. Mm-hmm. And for a new tree, it's only $100 if there's no tree been there before. So we're shouldering a lot of that cost mm-hmm. in a partnership with the homeowner. We only ask that they maintain it, water it, and care for it. Mm-hmm.
We talked about this before we went on the air. The city of Milwaukee has an urban forestry program that trains underrepresented populations for careers in forestry. And that might be something that people find surprising, because there actually are careers in forestry. It's something that most of us don't think about, you know.
Beyond Yogi Bear.
Yeah, exactly. It doesn't really have anything to do with that. But one of our board members wanted to ask if you have any similar plans, or would it be feasible to do a jump start or a pilot?
We'd be open to that. We do use we are running several volunteer programs. We just met with some people last week, as a matter of fact, getting some disadvantaged people into our park system, working in groups, and we're going to go forward with that. In the past, we've had volunteer groups come in and from KYF and places like that. Mm-hmm. So it's something we could definitely look into. We don't have any program like that now. Again, we're pretty small. There's four arborists and me. Mm-hmm. But it's a good idea.
You've mentioned arborist versus forester, and I know a lot of people don't know what the difference is. So could you explain that?
Well, usually a forester is an arborist, mm-hmm. but an arborist doesn't have to be a forester. An arborist, I have arborists who, one of the better schools in the state is University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point. Mm-hmm. They have an arborist program where you can get a degree in mm-hmm. arboriculture and be an arborist. And the people I hire, the city hires, are all arborists. Either they have that degree or they've got the training. They've worked with Asplen and line clearing companies. So, and a forester usually just is more an administrative title. So they run the arborists, I guess you could say.
Right, and I think you said earlier the arborist is the chainsaw end of it.
Yes, it's the pointy end of the stick.
The pointy end of the stick, right.
Right, but we hope things don't get to that point. So. Well, we are about out of time, but we have really managed to cover a fair amount of ground here, and I think you've offered some really helpful enlightenment on the important work that you do and on the important role that trees play all around us. And I'm kind of hoping that as we've had this conversation, people, as they just drive down the streets of Kenosha, are going to pay a little more attention mm-hmm. to all of the trees that are around here and to and be grateful to you and your staff for the good work that you do in caring for them. So,
it's been a pleasure.
Dirk Nelson, City of Kenosha Forester, one of the two park supervisors here in the City of Kenosha. Great to have you here. Nan Calvert, you have some events that you want to tell us about in our closing minute or two.
I do indeed. And one is happening this evening at 6:30, and it's in the Biosciences Building right here at Gateway Technical Institute. It's presented by the Southeast Gateway Group of Sierra Club, our favorite Sierra group. And the program title is The Plight of Pollinators. Tim Fulton will be the main presenter, and many of us know Tim Fulton from his rather famous beekeeper and honey producer in the area. And the plight of pollinators, of course, is an important thing that we all need to pay attention to, not just honey-producing pollinators, but our native pollinators as well. So 6:30, Biosciences Building here at Kenosha Gateway Technical College. Secondly, Riverbend Nature Center is going to have a free ski and or snowshoe candlelit trail event at Riverbend on February 19th from 6 p.m. until 8 p.m. You can bring your own equipment or you can rent it there. In the event that there's no snow, but there will be snow, but in the event that there isn't snow, a candlelit trail hike will ensue. And lastly, I want to put the word out there that in springtime, and it's almost spring, you can feel it and you can see it in the light. Sino KRLT Conservancy will have a tree planting extravaganza. We'll be reforesting our acreage where we lost all of our ash trees. And here's the deal. All of the holes will already be prepared for you. So all you have to do is show up and bring your, you know, your planting gloves and your outdoor clothes and put the saplings into the hole and snug them up with soil and put a little water on them. We'll be giving away free oak whips to people who come to help us plant. All you have to do is get hold of our point of contact, and his name is Mark Lesko, and he can be reached at Mark_Lesko, that's L-E-S-K-O, at iCloud.com, and we'll be sending out notices and reminders. We want to have a bunch of people helping us plant our trees out at Sino, and we'll give you tours, and we'll even feed you sometimes. So
wonderful.
Yes.
That's a nice note on which to end, with a sort of a note of hope and determination in the face of this emerald ash borer. Nan Calvert, thank you so much for helping to arrange this conversation. And Dirk Nelson, once again, thank you for being here.
It's truly my pleasure.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, cartoonist Joe Martin from Lake Geneva. Support for The Morning Show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support for The Morning Show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information available at carthage.edu/grad. Our weather forecast is for cloudy seasonal conditions today. We'll be warming up today to a high of 27 degrees. Overnight, cloudy and cold, a low of 15 degrees. Tomorrow, Friday, will be cloudy with scattered snow showers, but very little accumulation. We'll have a high of 29. Sunny on Saturday with a high of 29. Clouding up a bit on Sunday with a high of 33 degrees. Monday, cloudy with a 40% chance of light snow and a high of 33 degrees. Our temperatures recede just a little bit back into the 20s on Tuesday and Wednesday. But again, nothing as bitterly cold as what we experienced earlier this week. We're about to join Wisconsin Public Radio for their classical music programming. And Dave McGrath is back at 12 noon with Midday here on WGTD HD Kenosha.